My name is Robert Barlow, but you can't find my grave in any of the asylum cemeteries.
From WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, you're listening to Who Lies Beneath the Asylum. I'm Sherry Russo. This is a podcast about restoring dignity and respect by giving a voice to the voiceless. Normally on this podcast, we talk about the information that we do know about the names and life stories of people who were buried under a numbered tombstone on the old Athens Lunatic Asylum grounds located in Athens, Ohio, near Ohio University. There were about 1,900 people who died while at the asylum. No family claimed them, and many were buried in one of three cemeteries that contain tombstones with just numbers, no names, no dates. However, today's podcast introduces you to people who died at the asylum who we know very little about, whose lives and time at the facility is pretty much a mystery, but whose stories are just as important for that very reason. What we do know are their names, and we're going to start today with Robert Barlow, who died at the asylum. No family claimed him, but he's not buried anywhere on the asylum grounds. Retired library archivist Doug McCabe has done extensive research on the people who died at the asylum and is joining us now. Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Well, Robert Barlow's name is in the asylum grave book, but there's no grave number next to it. He was just 42 years old when he died. And when you encountered his name in the grave book, but without a numbered tombstone, what were your first thoughts about that?
Well, the grave book does give a clue, and it says something to the effect of OU or Ohio U, something like that. Now, Ohio University, from its inception, had wanted to have a medical school as a part of the university. And that didn't happen until, my goodness, maybe 1988 or something like that. It was long after the university was established. But they did have, like, pre-med for years. And what happened here was a dozen men and two women their bodies were donated to Ohio University. I can only assume that this was for purposes of autopsy type things. I mean, they were always able to do autopsies up at the asylum itself. So this is, using these bodies for teaching Ohio University students anatomy and so forth. So it's really not so much an autopsy, but keeping the bodies for that. And there's, even to this day, there's a donated body program as a part of Ohio University. Even a friend of mine did exactly that. Upon her death, her body was donated to Ohio University for teaching purposes. The problem, though, is what happened to these bodies after that? And I've never been able to find out what Ohio University did with those bodies once they were finished with them.
Let's hear a first-person account of Robert's story now with the help of voice actor Lou Horvath and Doug McCabe.
My name is Robert Barlow, but you can't find my grave in any of the asylum cemeteries.
He represents somewhere close to a dozen patients who died at the asylum and are not buried at the asylum, but appear in the asylum gravebook. And he's not buried anywhere.
I was admitted to the asylum in 1892 as patient number 2689 from Lawrence County. I died here in 1906, but I was never buried.
Upon his death in 1906, his body was given to Ohio University. And I don't know where he is now. When there are those who die and the bodies are given to Ohio University, they do not appear to have any
relatives at all. There's just no way of making a contact. And it also seems as if these are done periodically, okay? So, you know, you have to wonder if maybe Ohio University, it's like, we've used up this last body, can you get us another one?
Doug, you said Robert was one of several who are listed in the grave book but aren't buried on the grounds. And you talked about, what was the number again? 12?
12 men and two women.
12 men and two women. So are there any records of how the decision was made about what bodies were given to Ohio University?
I have not seen any records to explain that. And so I am forced to guess, and it appears that no families could be found. Often what you'll find doing research on people buried at the asylum, families didn't claim them. There are certainly cases where families could not be found. In other cases, families could be found, and for whatever reason, the families decided not to bring the bodies home. In these cases, it could also be that it was convenient that Ohio University needed a body. And here's one, so have at it.
Wow, okay. So, you know, with others at the asylum that we've profiled and learned their stories, you know, I feel like there's something descendants can do to make it right, so to speak, by putting a named tombstone on the gravesite and giving them the respect and dignity that they deserve. But in the case of Robert and the others like him, what can be done? Is there anything that can be done?
All that can be done is to put up a marker with those 14 names and an explanation that they were handed over to Ohio University, and their final resting place is unknown.
Okay. Well, Doug, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you.
Joining us now is Paul LaRue. Paul is a retired social studies teacher and serves on the State Board of Education in Ohio. He's also conducted research projects involving veterans and unmarked graves. Paul, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Tell us about the project you worked on to identify unmarked graves in your home community.
Well, because of questions that my students had asked and by partnering with the cemetery, you know, we learned that you could get headstones for veterans because, again, the U.S. government has provided headstones for veterans at no cost since the 1870s, and it really kind of started us on a journey, and it was a journey that has taken us to five cemeteries in southern Ohio, and we have researched, ordered, and installed 70 headstones.
Wow, 70. That's so many, and there's so much more work to be done. I'm sure you know of other places that that this type of research could be done too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I would like to say that every veteran now has a marked grave, but we know that's not true. And it's a motivation, I guess, for folks who are interested in cemeteries and cemetery work to continue, because we're certainly not the only, there are folks around the country who are also interested in the same idea.
So when it comes to Robert, have you ever come across any situations like the one with Robert where the body had been donated but never buried and there's not a physical location to honor that person?
Actually, I've come across it twice. Once with a Black Civil War sailor and once with a decorated Black World War I soldier.
Wow. Can you tell us a little bit about what you learned when you looked into that?
Absolutely. It's interesting now because so much genealogy work you can do with, you know, a couple of clicks of your mouse. And I was looking for, and you can almost always find where someone's buried. And I really struggled. This was actually first with this Black Civil War sailor. Fortunately, I have a friend who's I call him a military genealogist. He's a really gifted genealogist. And by doing research, he was actually able to find the death certificate. And on this soldier's death, or on the sailor's death certificate, this is from Hamilton County, and I actually have it in front of me, and you can read it. And it's interesting. It says, body was donated to the Cincinnati Anatomical Society.
So in situations like that, because that's very similar, obviously, to what happened with Robert, what do you think could be done to recognize those who don't have a physical burial site?
Well, it is. And it's an interesting, I should mention that this, at the time of his death, this sailor was at the Hamilton County Infirmary.
Okay.
So
it's very similar.
I know that in some cases, cemeteries have a section where they have like a marker that has names of folks who have done this. But unfortunately, it is very hard to properly honor these folks if we're just simply not aware that their bodies were, again, I don't know if this sailor's body was donated with his, you know what I'm saying?
With his permission or not,
because I mean, at the time that he passes, he's in the county infirmary. And like I said, the only thing listing is that his body is donated to the Cincinnati Anatomical Society.
Wow. So why do you feel work like this is so important? Tracking down those who are buried under numbers and giving them names and trying to find a way to recognize people like Robert and the sailor that you mentioned.
Well, and you guys have done a great job of this with the work that you've been doing. What you're really doing is giving a voice to people that don't have a voice. I mean, there's no one to speak for these, you know, for these veterans. And again, we always talk about honoring them in a proper way. You know, one of the basic ways that we honor folks is with a headstone or with some kind of commemoration.
Alexander Nation, Grave 303, Cemetery 1, buried 1910.
Anna McKee, Grave Number 380, Cemetery 2, buried 1915.
In the cases of Alexandra Nation and Anna McKee, unlike Robert, we know where they're buried on the asylum grounds and the numbers they are buried under. And we also know a little bit more about their lives. However, both of their stories are also very mysterious in nature. So, Doug, what prompted you to look into the story of Alexandra Nation?
Well, to start with, what a name.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And then to find in the committal papers the reason for that name. This was a woman who was found wandering around and scooped up. And she could not provide any information about herself in any way. The committal papers on her are fascinating simply because most of the questions to be filled out are blank.
Hmm. Wow. So how many other completely unknown people, you know, without real names? Is she the only one buried at the asylum that you know of, or were there others?
She is the only female. There are, I think it's 7 or 8 John Does. So again, it's a matter of nobody could figure out who they were. And with Alexandra, it was, and I assume it would be the same with the John Does, people in the neighborhood or the area where this person was scooped up were asked, who is this person? Do you know anything about them? And they could find nothing.
Hmm.
So, now, when I say 7 or 8 John Does, that may or may not be all of them who were admitted to the asylum. Some could have recovered and been released, although I think it's probably closer to the truth that these were people who were so insane that they were kept at the asylum until their deaths.
While we now have a name for Alexandra Nation, we know it's not her real name. Let's hear a first-person account of her story now with the help of voice actress Jessica McCoskey and our Doug McCabe.
If you find the name Alexandra Nation rather unusual, there's a reason for that. The admission records are very interesting for what they don't have. To every question asked, the answer is unknown.
I was admitted to the asylum in 1901 as patient number 3496 from Vinton County. My story ended at the asylum, and very little is known about where it started.
She was found wandering in Vinton County, and no one knew her. So she apparently wandered into the county and was wandering around the county, and then the authorities picked her up, and she apparently was not communicable in any way. And instead of giving the name Jane Doe or something else, she's given this curious name of Alexandra Nation. And that is the name she has in the grave book.
Doug, were you ever able to find a reason that they used the name Alexandra Nation? It's so unusual.
Why not Jane Doe? I mean, why be so highfalutin, if you will? I don't know. And it certainly makes her stand out. I will say that. There's nobody else who has a name quite like that.
Absolutely. Okay. So Anna McKee's story has a few more details, but there's still a lot of mystery around it. She was admitted to the asylum twice. Talk about the fact that she was discharged and deemed incurable at what point. What do you think that means?
The stated goal from day one, and I think it's fair to say throughout the history of the Athens Asylum, was to recover these people. That the object was to have them be able to return to society. Mm-hmm. So, and we can find a number of examples, even with people buried at the asylum, of multiple intakes and outtakes, if you will. I can remember one person was admitted six times.
Wow.
So, you know, it's like, okay, it's decided they're good enough to go back into society, and then maybe something else happens or whatever. In deciding about incurable, who knows how that might have come about. It's there could be all kinds of reasons, you know, just because of behavior that somebody could not exist outside of the asylum. I mean, there is that kind of, I don't know if it's, you know, a medical condition term or not, but just they've become so institutionalized that they cannot function outside of the institution.
All right. Thank you, Doug, so much for being here.
Oh, thank you.
Now it's time to hear Anna's first-person style account with the help of voice actress Liz Shaw and Doug.
I was admitted to the asylum twice, once on June 11th, 1879, as patient number 898 from Meigs County, and again January 12th, 1900, as patient number 3364.
There's a note on the admission record that she had been seduced about a year beforehand. She was involved in a sexual encounter, whether it be consensual or not. It could be either, actually. Such a thing was considered very bad from a social standpoint.
Now joining us is Jackie Wolf. She's a professor of the history of medicine at Ohio University and specializes in the history of women's health and children's health, along with the history of public health and the history of biomedical ethics. She's also the host of WOUB's Lifespan podcast. Jackie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Sherry.
So there isn't much known about either of these women. When it comes to Alexandra, we really know nothing. But with Anna, the asylum paperwork says she was seduced. Can you talk about what that could possibly mean?
You know, it could have meant that she was raped. It could have meant that she had an affair outside of marriage. It could have meant that it was completely consensual and that she had fallen in love with someone. And it could have meant that she sought companionship outside of marriage because she was in an abusive marriage. You know, I could go on and on with mm-hmm. possible scenarios. You know, the word seduced was probably it was a word that could have meant many different things. It indicates to me that what it probably meant, either that she was raped, or that it's simply a reference to her having sexual activity outside of marriage.
Okay. So we talked about this before with women who were admitted to the asylum, but can you talk again about the treatment of women at this time? They really had no input or say into what happened to them.
Well, you know, it depended. It depended on whether or not they had a man at their side standing up for them, whether it was an adult son or a husband or a father. What concerns me about what Anna probably went through is the reference to her being seduced. I mean, that really kind of diminished her as a person. The punishment for women who had sex outside of marriage, I can't exaggerate it enough. You know, one of the reasons why politicians and physicians and, you know, all kinds of different professional groups were against effective contraception for women was that they really wanted to control women's sexuality. And for women to have sex outside of marriage, the punishment would have been the unimaginable shame of a pregnancy outside of marriage, or the unimaginable knowledge of an entire town knowing that a woman had sex outside of marriage. And that kind of shame, that kind of stigma, was really used to control women. So that's why I'm very interested just by this word seduced. I mean, this was, you know, this is a cloak of shame. This is a woman who was terribly stigmatized for whatever this activity was.
Wow. So when you know, we use that word, or when they used that word seduced, does it surprise you at all that a woman who had been seduced would not have been claimed by her family for burial?
You know, it wouldn't surprise me, because I say the punishment for sexual activity outside of marriage, I mean, it was a deliberate social punishment to control women's behavior. And that was one reason why the fight for effective contraception was so hard fought, because the fear in society was that if a woman could prevent an unwanted pregnancy, women would go nuts. Women would become uncontrollable. So, you know, this is a history that we all need to remember. When things like reproductive rights are under threat, you know, this is the kind of world that reproductive rights were fought for in, because the memory then of the way women were treated was fresh. It's not so fresh anymore.
Well, that's a wonderful point. And do you still think that we are fighting that stigma today?
You know, if you had asked me that 10 years ago, I would have said, no, not really. Today, in 2021, when there are Supreme Court cases about whether or not contraception should be made available by employers, and that becomes a controversy, when we are once again fighting what we thought we had fought and won 50 years ago for legalized and safe abortion, we're fighting those fights again. And I think that's why this history is so important, so that we understand what women's lives were like before they were able to control their reproductive systems, their own bodies.
We are no longer just grave numbers in the Athens Asylum cemeteries.
My name is Alexandra Nation.
My name is Anna McKee.
I don't have a grave on these grounds, or anywhere for that matter, but my name is Robert Barlow.
And that is the story and impact of Alexandra Nation, Anna McKee, and Robert Barlow. Now we turn to you. We want to hear your stories about long-lost relatives in your families who you believe may have died at institutions like the Athens Asylum, located across the country. We'd love to share your story and see if the work done in Athens might lead you to some answers. Email us at wholiesbeneath@woub.org. Thank you for listening, and until next time, take care of each other. Who Lies Beneath the Asylum is a production of WOUB Public Media in Athens, Ohio, written by me, Sherry Russo. Adam Rich is our audio engineer. Artwork by Sean Anderson. Special thanks to Doug McCabe, Jackie Wolf, and Paul LaRue for contributing their knowledge and voices to this podcast, and Lou Horvath, Jessica McCoskey, and Liz Shaw for their work as the voices of Robert Barlow, Alexandra Nation, and Anna McKee. If you like the show, please rate and subscribe or visit woub.org to learn more.